We will open the Senate Revenue Committee. Sorry for the delay. We have been receiving some further news on the state of the Oregon economy, and so that delayed us 30 minutes. I think it delayed all Senate committees, but I apologize to folks who came down who wanted to be here at 1. We're going to start at just a little bit tardy, and we should expect the caucuses have ended, so expect the other two or three members to arrive. I'm going to open a public hearing on... on Senate Bill 87, on Senate Bill 88, and Senate Bill 89. And I think I will, this is only a public hearing for folks that are watching for a possible work session, so this is a chance just to have testimony on the school revenue formula as it relates to districts that are growing, and I will turn it over to my colleague, Senator Ringo, to introduce the bills.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to go down each of these and describe them. I'll let our committee assistant help with the details of that. But I guess I'm disappointed that we don't have our three rural colleagues here today, because if the three of us were to vote right now, maybe we could get these just passed out. But for me, this is a discussion that is very, very important for our state to have. And unfortunately, it does tend to pit different parts of the state against each other, urban versus rural. And that's an unfortunate aspect whenever you deal with a school funding formula. For me, I think it's really crucial that the senators and representatives from the other parts of the state realize what a tremendous burden growth is to the school districts in Washington County and other parts of the state, but particularly Washington County, and what a devastating impact it's having to our ability to guarantee a quality education. And given that Washington County really is the economic engine of the state, based on knowledge, based on technology, that it's just absolutely essential, not just for the people who live in our part of the state, but for the entire state, that we don't kill the cash cow that is helping the entire state. And this is a message that I think it's crucial that members of all, representing all districts of the state, understand. So that, let's just go into the technical details, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think we're going to, since we have a number of folks who want to testify, we're going to have to limit the time on the testimony to maybe we'll start with 5 minutes. But to introduce the bills, I think we'll first bring up Mike Osborne and Don. And if there's other folks that have come from a distance away, I'm only finding one on our sign-up sheet. So Jeanette, you will be next, but if there's others that want to testify that have come from a distance that didn't mark it on the sign-up sheets, just let me know and we'll hear from you first. Mr. Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Mike Osborne, a member of the Beaverton School Board. I'm here today to voice support for Senate Bills 87, 88, and 89, or alternatives that address higher operating and facility costs faced by school districts with sustained student enrollment growth. As you know, I have a tendency to digress and probably will. We've submitted written testimony, and I urge you to read that in case I miss some of these things, as I'm going to try to keep within the 5 minutes. On behalf of the Beaverton School District, I want to thank Senators Ringo and Starr and other co-sponsors for introducing these measures, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for agreeing to hear them. First, let's talk about enrollment growth, which is no economic bonanza for schools. Washington County K-12 enrollment increased more than 32% over the last decade. That percentage represents the addition of 17,604 additional students. Beaverton's growth in enrollment totaled 8,236 students, almost half of the new students attending Washington County schools. To put that enrollment gain in perspective, if those additional 8,236 kids in Beaverton schools were in their own school district, it would be larger than districts such as Corvallis, Roseburg, and Lake Oswego. Think of the school facility infrastructure in districts that size and think about what it takes to add the teachers, the classrooms, the cafeterias, school buses, books, desks, and supplies required to accommodate students. And Beaverton was forced to assemble that infrastructure in real time on the fly over the last 10 years. Many around Oregon wish they had the economic prosperity of communities such as Beaverton and Hillsboro. We agree we're very fortunate in that respect. But it's important to remember that the increased amounts of income tax revenue generated by the businesses and workers in our communities do not flow into our own bank account. Yes, we realize higher property tax receipts from our school levies, but our reward is to receive less in state funding under the state school fund equalization formula. I'm going to say that again. We realize higher property tax receipts from our school levies, but as you know with the offset, we receive less in state funding under the state school fund equalization formula. Growth doesn't give schools in Beaverton a financial bonanza. Growth gives us more students to house, teach, feed, transport to and from school. Oregon's down economy has slowed enrollment growth but not stopped it. The Center for Population Research and the Census at Portland State University projects Beaverton student enrollment in 2020 will reach more than 45,000 students and be 62% larger than in 1995. That means building the infrastructure in our district to accommodate another 12,000 students in the next 15 years or so. And in spite of this down economy, Beaverton's been growing at 800 or 900 students a year over the last 8 years that I've been involved volunteering. This year, in a down year, we grew 600, and next year we're going to grow 500. Schools need additional financial tools. To do that, Beaverton and other high-growth school districts, regardless of size, this is not a large versus small district issue. This is about growth. You go down state a little bit and find some high-growing school districts like Sherwood. They have the same issues. They need additional financial tools, not to mention school sites, to meet this very real and daunting challenge. Let me start with school capital improvements. Beaverton has persuaded its patrons 5 times in the last decade to approve school bond measures, which total $382.5 million, or just under $2 per thousand of assessed valuation in the current tax year. Senate Bill 87, which we refer to as a growth increment bill, allows school districts to capture for 5 years the additional property tax revenue generated by the K-12 school levy on exception values, which is generally the new construction in their community. This revenue now is added to our base amount of locally generated property tax revenue and serves in high-growth districts to decrease the amount of state funding we receive. Once again, the more we add locally, the more we receive less from the general fund. It's not a criticism of statewide school funding equalization to observe that taxpayers in high-growth communities fail to understand why increased property tax revenue doesn't go to benefit students in those communities. Instead, high-growth districts such as Beaverton are forced to go ask patrons to approve large bond measures, adding to their tax burden to pay for more classrooms in new or expanded schools. SB 87 recognizes this political problem with our current system and lets districts use their growth increment on capital needs, whether it's more classrooms or renovation of aging existing schools. There are other capital facility tools we support. We would like the authority to level school impact fees, which the state now prohibits us from imposing. We would like you to remove the cap on the facility grant that is in the current school distribution formula to cover costs such as desks and lab equipment that we no longer can legally include in school bonds. We also support state bonding to cover all or part of new school facility costs, including the cost to retrofit school facilities to new higher seismic codes. Student enrollment growth always results in marginal operating costs that aren't addressed in the existing distribution formula. The best way I can describe these marginal costs is to note that new students arrive in the fall, requiring us to hire more teachers and classrooms, often portables, buy desks and books, and increase our bus fleet. However, the money for all those expenses doesn't fully arrive until up to a year later. And I can tell you in Beaverton, we have learned the hard way that if we don't allow the new principal and core teachers some time for a full year in advance of opening a school to plan for that school opening does not go well. 4 or 5 years ago when we opened Findlay Elementary, which I was privileged to serve on the local school committee there, we only gave the principal half a year without any teaching support to go out and get the curriculum, to hire teachers, to put the teams together, and it was a real struggle. We've learned we have to give that new principal a full year. We have to carve out a planning team of teachers. That means substitutes or soft costs well in advance of opening those days that come out of our general fund. Senate Bills 88 and 89 are two ways to recognize other marginal costs. Senate Bill 88 adds a capital construction adjustment factor to the distribution formula that takes into account the amount of property taxes paid for school bonds to pay for capital facilities. The adjustment effectively reduces the amount of local property tax revenue a district contributes to the state school fund formula calculation. In a meaningful way, it is a first step toward achieving full equity in school funding by taking into account both local property taxes generated for school operations and school facilities. Senate Bill 89 takes another tack. It adds an additional weighting factor for new students attending large, high-growth districts. In previous sessions, we have worked on other tools, such as a growth factor, to recognize the marginal costs of sustained student enrollment growth. We are open to working on the issue to develop other tools if necessary. Again, Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing these bills and affording us the opportunity to describe the economic challenges posed by growth in our communities without adequate tools to accommodate the higher operating and facility costs resulting from more students. And more importantly, I'd like to say thanks to the members of my community in Beaverton who I've slaved on Saturdays and Sundays putting together the new desks in these new schools because we don't have the janitor's time to do it. And it's nothing we can fund with bond money. And that's the kind of stuff we do to get those schools open. The parents are in there hanging the stuff in the classrooms, putting together the desks, in a lot of cases helping finish off the punch list too. I'd be happy as an individual representing my community to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mike. Tom?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dawn Bonder. My son Matthew is a second grader attending Jacob Wismer Elementary School in the Beaverton School District. I am a member of Jacob Wismer Site Council, an active member in the PTO, and a member of the Steering Committee for Citizens for Beaverton Schools. Additionally, I am president of my Neighborhood Homeowners Association. I'm here today to voice support for Senate Bills 87, 88, and 89, which address the unique needs of school districts in high-growth areas. My comments are based upon observations made as a parent, as well as a concerned and active community member. I'd like to share with you anecdotal evidence of what explosive growth looks like. In the 6 years from 1995 to 2001, my neighborhood was moved in and out of four different elementary school boundary areas. At each school, the students came and came until the school could no longer hold them inside or in the portable classroom set up outside at a cost of approximately $85,000 each. Our third neighborhood school, Finley Elementary, was opened for the 1997-98 school year, and by the 99-2000 school year was closed to new students due to overcrowding. In an effort to ease that overcrowding, the district decided to move the entire kindergarten program to portable classrooms set on the site where the next elementary school would be built. The district incurred the added expenses of creating the site, the portables, duplication of services, and transportation. Additionally, the district incurred a large dose of ill will that cannot easily be translated into a dollar amount. Unbelievably, we are not the only community within the Beaverton School District to be experiencing this type of growth. The burden of opening new school, year after year, is staggering. As Mike told you, our school district has asked its citizens to approve bond measures 5 times in the last 10 years, and each time our citizens came through with a vote of support, even if it didn't always pass the double majority. These dollars supported the purchase of land, the construction and repairs of buildings, and the purchase of certain fixtures for the new building. These bond dollars did not pay for the additional staff that is needed with a new or expanded school, nor did the bond dollars pay for supplies, library books, textbooks, copy machines, or computers. These bond dollars do not pay for the staff that needs to be in place while a new school is under construction. A planning team is necessary, but there is no allocation to fully cover that overhead. All of these additional funds necessary to make a school really a school, the staff, technology, and supplies, must be culled from the school district's general fund. These dollars are therefore not available for programs throughout the district. The Beaverton School District receives the same number of dollars per student as districts that are not growing, yet we can use fewer of these dollars to educate our students. It creates a penalty for growing districts that is clearly unfair. Although our school district pays for the additional expenses arising from growth beyond funding that the bond measures supply, I don't want you to think that this means our schools are getting all that they need. When Jacob Wismer opened in September 2001, our 650 students were restricted to one library book per visit because we didn't have enough books to go around. In order to increase our volumes to the national average for 725 students that we expect for the 03-04 year, we need upwards of $60,000. Based on current levels of state funding, Jacob Wismer cannot expect the district to be providing those funds. So, if we want to strive to make our library average, we need to raise that money ourselves. It's the parents and community members that must bridge the gap in these new schools. At Jacob Wismer, it was the PTO that has paid for the science materials, recess and PE supplies, music and art supplies, die cuts, and additions to the media center. And this is on top of providing for programs that state funding leaves our schools without, such as field trips, assemblies, art literacy, science fair, and the geography program. High-growth school districts are penalized by growth, and the new school community itself is financially burdened by this growth. These school districts and communities need some relief. When parents and community members are already paying to bring school infrastructure to average levels, as well as to keep basic programs afloat, it becomes harder and harder to continue to ask for more money. Each bond measure is increasingly difficult to pass, and use of a local option levy increasingly challenging. Additionally, I'm not sure what hurts us more. The number of citizens that do not understand that increased property tax revenue doesn't directly benefit students in their district, or those that do understand the percentage of their tax dollars that are contributing to non-growth communities due to the current school funding formula. All of these things together put the Beaverton School District and other high-growth districts at a real disadvantage. I want to thank Senators Ringo and Starr for sponsoring these bills and Chairman Deckert for agreeing to hear them. High-growth school districts need to be compensated for the great burden they are shouldering. If we cannot maintain quality schools in our high-growth areas, what hope do we have of improving our economy statewide? I've included my written comments with my name and contact information, and please feel free to contact me if I can be of any assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I know both of you guys have a great deal of other things you could be doing right now, so thank you for coming. Questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for coming down here. A couple questions. One is, perhaps for Mike, what are the plans that Beaverton School District has for new construction over the next decade or so? What are you planning on building?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, at the rate that we're growing is estimated, we put together and keep updating a long-range planning committee, so we try to stay ahead of the eight ball on growth. So we're always looking out 3, 4, 5. We have a 20-year plan, actually, and that helps us plan for when we need to go out for bond measures. At the rate we're growing right now, and we're still working off of our last bond measure, but it means essentially we have to open a school a year, a decent-sized elementary school. So right now we are going out trying to gather land in our land bank to be able to build, and certainly you've probably seen the press. We've had to take measures as such as condemnation to acquire land. But right now we need two elementary schools and one middle school today. If it was open today, those three schools would be full after we got done redistricting. And certainly it's not too long in the future where we need to open a comprehensive high school. Right now, Westview High School is the largest high school in the state with over 2,400 students and has, I'm not sure how many it is, I think it's 28 portables and currently adding 16 classrooms to that school. So we are a little bit behind the eight ball, even though we've been planning out 20 years in advance.
Thank you. Just to follow up, thanks, Mike. Are you aware of businesses complaining that they may be considering locating in Washington County and have expressed dissatisfaction with the overcrowding of schools and the potential problems with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, it's very apparent, and certainly Intel, which is the largest employer in our area, I see a lot of those people all the time in the business that I'm in, and also am working in the city of Beaverton, also and go to Rotary Club and those kinds of things. And we are getting a reputation, not just statewide, but certainly in our community, that we're not too awfully good at funding. And people like Dawn here, who live this every day, volunteering in the classroom, the word spreads. And there's nothing more personal to people than their education of their kids. And they don't like the idea that they're going to have an elementary school where their kid's going to be in there with 30 kids, or they're going to have a high school with 50 kids in the classroom getting a lecture. Those kinds of class sizes are the things that we're looking at as a school board to try to get through what's going on. Plus, where it's a double whammy. When you don't have the operating money, it doesn't matter if you build the schools because you can't hire the teachers to reduce the class sizes. So we are caught in a downward spiral here, as you well know. Thank you for joining us, Senator. I didn't see you come in. In a downward spiral, turn my head to the left once in a while. In a downward spiral,
I turn my head to the left a lot.
For Mike, that's a
I'm not used to getting one up. We're in a downward spiral right now that is causing businesses to rethink, besides the land use planning that's going on in Washington County and with Metro and stuff. So we're getting it from all sides to answer your question.
Okay, but just focusing for a minute on the impact it's having on businesses that are considering locating to Washington County, you've had conversations and know of instances where that is a factor.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Further? Mike, one of the things in your chair of the Budget Committee that I hear, certainly through the years, is, and you touched upon this in your testimony, Don, you did also, just bond for it. And how would you answer that concern that you're getting 30% growth? Can't you just bond for this 30% annual growth?
Mr. Chairman, I am the former chairman of the Budget Committee. Thankfully, that task has been handed off this year after 2 years of difficult times. We get that. People talk about that. And we even had testimony last night at our school board meeting saying, why aren't you pursue the local option? Well, what I can tell you is people like Don and myself have been volunteering for years working to try to pass these things. The resistance is increasing, and it's easy thing to say, well, we'll just bond for it. If the people want it, let them pay for it. The reality at the end of the day when not everybody has a child in school makes that option less feasible all the time. And what's happening, especially in our community, as with the press coverage and these issues, as you've read with ESDs and the state funding, people's awareness is getting pretty high that, you know, somehow we're in a fast-growing district and it's not equitable. And they read about districts that have smaller populations and a lot more money at the end of the day. So we're getting an increasing resistance in our community. And quite honestly, you go around the Beaverton area and businesses and all of them are saying, why aren't we living in Vancouver, Washington? You know, that's where they all want to move. And I know high-tech executives at Intel, at Carillion, at other major employers, and they have moved across the river in the last couple of years. And that hurts us in a lot of different ways. I don't need to enumerate those.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mrs. Ortman, Ms. Huntington, and Ms. Biller.
Soak it up. Well, how did Washington County vote on 28? They defeated it, didn't they?
Well, I voted yes.
Are we missing one?
We are reconfiguring.
We're down one.
We're reconfiguring a little bit. My name is Carolyn Ortman, and I am a board member with the Hillsborough School District, and I have Patty McLeod with me, who is a parent in the district, and she'll be able to introduce herself a little better and more thoroughly than I could. I would say to open that we appreciate the opportunity to provide some additional information that Beaverton has so eloquently provided for you today regarding the impact of rapid growth to our district and describe just what it means for the Hillsborough School District. In 1994, the patrons in Hillsborough approved a bond to build Century High School. That was the last of bond approval that allowed us to use bonding money to equip the school and to help offset costs for planning. Since then, constraints of ballot measure 47 and 50 have dramatically limited what we can do with bond funds. Since 1998, not too very many years ago, Hillsborough voters have approved the construction of Patterson Elementary, Orenco Elementary, Imlay Elementary, Witch Hazel Elementary, Liberty High School, and a major remodel renovation of Hillsborough High School. The voter commitment is just about $180 million. That resulted in construction of over 550,000 square feet of additional school space. These schools are designed to accommodate 4,400 additional students. Like Beaverton, we're going to be opening Liberty High School this next year, and our schools will be full when they open. While these are admirable statistics and they illustrate the support of our local taxpayers, sometimes we are envied by small or declining school districts, but it masks the problem that goes unnoticed through most of the state, and that is Hillsborough's need for additional school space and our success in securing patron support create a situation in which our general fund dollars are supporting the additional cost of that construction. It's difficult to explain to my patrons why I need to buy a desk out of general fund dollars. They say, just don't open the schools. Let's just pack them in. And then we have the same problem that Beaverton was discussing, where you have 50 students potentially in a high school class. That is not good education. To illustrate, we currently house 5,300 students in grades 9 through 12 at our three high schools. When we open Liberty next year, we'll have those students distributed among four high schools, much better sizes and much more realistic. But with that comes the additional cost with four high school principals, four cafeterias, utility costs, and other incremental expenses that are not shared by moving students to another site, libraries. That was addressed, custodial, food service. These are all costs that fast-growing districts have to absorb. Hillsborough's assessed evaluation in 1997 was $5.257 billion. 5 years later, our value is up nearly 58% to $8.186 billion. One of my roles that I've taken on for many years is I chair the Citizens Hillsborough Citizens for Schools Committee. I get to explain on a very regular basis why the increased property tax revenue in Hillsborough does not translate to benefit for Hillsborough students. I'm not sure I've done a great job so far because I'm not sure that there is a really good reason, but the political challenge of trying to explain that is pretty daunting. Senate Bill 87 recognizes the flaw in the current situation, and it does allow for districts to direct a portion of growth to capital needs within the school district where revenue is generated. Whether to renovate aging facilities or acquire additional classroom space at existing crowded schools, the dedication of local funds acknowledges the continuing dilemma for growing districts as well as contribution of locally taxpayers to local programs. Senate Bill 88 further provides for innovative effort to reward those local taxpayers for accepting responsibility for bonded debt by reducing the amount of the local property tax revenue that the district contributes to the state school fund. Senate Bill 89 would implement the reverse of the declining student population factor, which has long been a part of the funding formula, by providing a factor for high-growth school districts. I think important to me as a board member is I don't want to make this a large district, small district battle, but all I'm asking for is a recognition that the problem that we have, while it may be different, is still a problem, and I would never take away a declining enrollment district acknowledgement that they have a problem, but we have a problem too. There are those who will oppose these bills because they do take a piece of that funding. During the last session, a formula change was made to help smaller remote districts to address those real problems. We just want the acknowledgement that this is a real problem. Corrections are made for declining small, remote, poor, and others. A correction for rapid growth and other related costs needs to be addressed. You will encounter heated debates as we to the needs that we have briefly described. However, you do have within the law currently an existing LifeBuoy that we desperately need, and it was addressed a little bit by Beaverton, and that's the facility factor. It is in place, and it's intended to help provide the one-time costs for districts opening new instructional space. We would ask for you to fully fund that. We need it to help us specifically with our new schools. We appreciate the legislative sponsorship of Senator Starr and Ringo to help introduce these bills and the hearing that you have provided, Chair Deckert. We do recognize the difficulty facing the Oregon legislature, and we just want you to know that we have our struggles back home, and we're acknowledging the struggles you have here. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Carol.
Good afternoon, Senator Deckert and committee. My name is Patty McLeod. I'm first and foremost a parent in the Hillsborough School District. This year I'm also serving as chairperson for the Citizens Curriculum Committee, and I'm also serving as chairperson for a fairly newly formed Special Education Parent Advisory Committee. I'd like to share with you my concerns. Along with instilling good values for my children, their education has been of utmost importance to me. That is why I am here today representing my views and those of other parents in our community. As a parent and taxpayer, I have worked to become more informed about my school district, its challenges, how it works, and what I can do to help. One of the things that I consistently hear is, Hillsborough is growing so fast, you probably have more money than you can handle for schools. That common misunderstanding, which is founded in the previous property tax structure that supported schools prior to the early 1990s, is a difficult problem to explain. How is it that all the new business, new housing, greater congestion, and taxpayer approval for more schools do not translate into more money for our students in the schools? I have heard the explanation, and I try to understand the school funding formula of local and state revenue as much as anyone. What I don't understand is the lack of tools that our district can use to help offset the cost of the very growth that helps support the rest of the state in school funding. I helped pass bond measures which provided revenue to build several new schools. As a taxpayer, I have agreed to increase my property tax to support that construction. And then I have seen the general fund budget used to equip those new schools. Districts without new construction do not face that drain on their general fund. It only makes sense that when a district has 26 schools in 1996 and 31 schools in 2003, you have more principals, more custodial crews, more utility costs, and all the other things that go with operating a school. Senate Bills 87, 88, and 89 will have opposition by school districts that do not understand how growth can work against us in funding our children's education. Please help us explain and push forward the reality that our growth is a benefit for the entire state and in some ways is a burden only to us. We are open to other kinds of tools to resolve the problem using the same pot of general fund resources for more and more schools. But we have built five schools and waited a long time for a solution. Although we generate more in property tax, we don't benefit from it. These bills are an attempt to use a real opportunity to help those districts whose growth has helped school funding statewide. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for coming down. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. What does Hillsborough project as far as schools construction in the next 5 or 10 years?
We currently know that we need to go out for some new middle schools. We also have the South Urban Reserves that have been opened up, so that will generate some need for additional elementary schools. We're building Witch Hazel Elementary right now there, but in the next 5 years I would anticipate some elementary in Cornelius, some middle school in the South Urban Reserves, and over by our new Liberty High School, and some additional elementary schools in both of those locations as well, probably another 5 to 6 schools.
Okay, thank you. I mean, similar to the approximate one school per year that Beaverton is forecasting? Maybe a little more?
We are just a little bit about half the size of Beaverton. So when you look at Beaverton, uh-huh, if you half what they're doing, that appears to be about half of what that appears to be our scenario. So I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, we need to have probably 7 to 8 schools.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Karen.
Senator Ringo.
Do you also have a large number of high-tech workers in the district that really rely on a good education system?
Yes. Intel does. Most of the Intel property is in the Hillsborough School District, and that's, and then this, it's not just the Intels, it's the supporting other industries that help Intel and the other kinds of electronic. It's a huge issue, and rightfully so, the demands of all parents are that their kids need to be educated in a way that will provide them the knowledge and ability to go to those high-tech industries and be able to have opportunity for employment. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lawner, and we'll bring up with Mr. Erland and Mr. Vroman.
Yes, can I just take a glance at the sheet?
Sure. Good afternoon. Sorry, we're running a little late today. The budget is not performing like we'd like it to. Greetings.
It's a fine, how do you do?
Ms. Lump.
Thank you. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Lawner, and I'm an attorney today representing the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. The Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies is a statewide organization that represents Oregon's 47 urban renewal agencies. AORA is seriously concerned about the portion of Senate Bill 87 that dedicates taxes derived from any exception value within certain urban renewal areas exclusively to the schools. First of all, we believe that changes to the property tax system might best be considered as a package rather than one issue at a time. The impact on urban renewal when individual problems are taken on piecemeal is one about which we are very concerned. Secondly, urban renewal remains one of the only tools to promote economic opportunity and redevelopment that's tailored to local needs and local priorities. The majority of the funds to pay for these community-based projects comes from property tax on the exception value. And that, of course, is primarily from new improvement value. Commonly, one quarter to one third of the property tax rate applied to this exception value is from school district operating levies. Therefore, Senate Bill 87 would reduce significantly the tax increment revenues that are available to fund projects and new urban renewal plans. Now, Senate Bill 87 not only curtails the potential for new urban renewal plans, it will also affect existing plans if they are substantially amended after the effective date of the bill. Urban renewal plans are commonly amended as circumstances, local priorities, and project costs change. The state law requires that each plan state what kind of a plan change is considered substantial, and the local determination of substantial change varies widely from district to district. Applying the provisions of Senate Bill 87 to existing plans will either jeopardize the funding of those plans and their capacity to pay outstanding debt, or will prevent the adoption of substantial amendments that may be necessary or prudent in the local context. Finally, we want you to understand that the tax increment revenues represent a stream of funds that are necessary to pay long-term debt. Bond markets tend to look at a bill like this in the legislature that jeopardizes revenue streams for long-term debt, and they get nervous. This nervousness can unfortunately translate into economic punishment to more than the bonds that are actually affected by a curtailing of the revenue stream, and could cost governments more money in the long run when they try to sell debt. In summary, AORA urges the committee to carefully consider the impact of Senate Bill 87 on the successful redevelopment of our statewide community, and to not include in any final bill the restriction on tax increment collections. Thank you.
Thank you. questions? Thank you for coming from the coast. I think it's beautiful on the coast right now.
Well, it was when I left.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. May I be excused? I have a meeting at 3.
Absolutely. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ray Erling, Clackamas County Assessor, and with me is Bob Vroman. He's the manager of our tax calculation in Clackamas County. We'd like to talk today about some potential impacts of Measure 87. First one, it appears there could be a significant increase in assessment and taxation, administrative and programming costs. Counties have differing capabilities to segregate, report, and use exception value in tax calculations and distributions. They have different computer systems. It appears there would be significant programming required for the change in the urban renewal calculations. Last year, we were fortunate to barely get out the tax statements with the Shiloh Inn case and the amount of overtime and programming required to accomplish that. It appears there would be additional programming required for distribution audit and reporting of the revenue raised for the school capital project fund. Bob is going to talk about urban renewal and relationships to this bill.
Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. As you may well understand, if you've had much of a discussion on urban renewal in the past, that it always raises significant concerns when it looks like it may change the way we calculate it. In Senate Bill 87, new exception value within existing urban renewal agencies or agency plans would go to the school districts instead of the urban renewal district. This creates additional complexity as we see it in potentially calculating our tax roll and calculating the amounts of money when we have an already very complex urban renewal tax calculation. As you look around the state, there are 22 counties, I believe, that do have urban renewal agencies. We have a lot of urban renewal in Clackamas County. We have countywide plans as well as city plans. And counties certainly have differing degrees of funding capability and the ability to implement programming changes when they're necessary. As Ray mentioned earlier, we're sort of rebounding from the Shiloh Inn decision, which actually was a significant change to the urban renewal calculation last year. It made producing a timely tax roll and an accurate tax roll very difficult, to be frank. In Clackamas County, the number of tax rates that we needed to calculate our tax roll ballooned from 196 to 594 just to calculate taxes for the people in Clackamas County. And whenever there are technical questions, which Senate Bill 87 does bring up as to how we might implement this, a lot of times those types of things will need to be answered before we can fully assess the impact this may have on our organizations. I think one thing that's key to understand, and that is we calculate taxes on a property-by-property basis. So when there's a concept that says we want to direct certain types of monies, whether they come from the increment from an urban renewal agency to a particular type of taxing district or funding entity, you know, that raises a red flag for us in how we're going to translate that down to calculating taxes on a property-by-property basis, testing compression appropriately according to the Constitution, and making sure that we have an accurate tax statement and representation of taxes that we can explain to a taxpayer. And that's become very, very difficult with the way the calculation currently exists, and we see the potential for that calculation to get more complex with Senate Bill 87. Thank you again, and we would just hope that you would consider that in any decision you make in trying to arrange funding for certainly a very important cause, school districts, and consider those impacts that you might have to the assessment and taxation system. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, another comment would be that an unforeseen consequence of the way the bill appears to be at this point is many property owners would see tax increases. Urban renewal agencies would receive fewer dollars from the division of tax, but for existing plans, they're made whole by the increasing taxes collected from the special levy. So so what we could see, at least in Clackamas County and many counties, would be that if this bill was enacted as written, is they would still pay, they would make the urban renewal agencies whole, and we would increase the special levy as required by law, so urban renewal would receive the money to pay off their bonded debt for those existing plans. Again, thank you today for hearing our testimony.
Thank you. Sliringa.
Thank you. With respect to that last point, do you have any reason to think we couldn't straighten out the bill to address that issue, just to make sure that we don't increase people's taxes? What's that?
Chairman Deckard, members of the Senator Ringo, I don't see an immediate way without potentially jeopardizing funding to urban renewal districts, which could raise some legal issues where they have some protection from, I think it's an impairment of contracts situation, which once an income stream or a revenue stream is dedicated in some fashion or earmarked for the reduction of bonded debt, that there are some limitations as to how you can impair that.
Well, I guess I would need to sort through this argument a little closer, but I don't understand why you couldn't write in a provision just to say it wouldn't have that impact. Why can't you just write the bill around that problem?
Again, I don't see how that would be accomplished, you know, without either saying there's going to be less money going to urban renewal agencies or defeat the purpose of the bill, which is to get additional funds to school districts. If you're going to accomplish getting additional funds to school districts and still allow existing urban renewal agencies to collect all the funds that they're currently entitled to by law, I see a problem with, you know, with crafting something that would accomplish that.
Could you legally,
I may not be the person to address that.
Just based on your knowledge, could you prospectively fix that loophole by prospectively, and it would be taking some of the urban renewal dollars to fill that gap and just eliminate, I don't know which line it is in the bill, but rewrite that line to accomplish the goal.
Again, Senator or Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, I'm not sure there's a way to accomplish that. This bill sort of has a time frame of 5 years, and if you were think back to if there was any familiarity at all with House Bill 3215, I believe last year, which adjusted urban renewal agencies' ability to collect urban renewal dollars from new bonded debt and new local options. I think it was ultimately determined that was crafted in that fashion for just this reason, is that you couldn't make that apply to all urban renewal agencies because you would again impair their ability to collect dedicated funds for bonded debt retirement. So, that, again, I think it would be something that you would refer to the legal people to maybe potentially provide some direction in crafting something like that if it were possible.
Thank you.
Dr. Radich, Peggy Blanche, anyone else traveling?
Chip Lazenby. He's traveling all around the state.
Getting too many cell phones this afternoon. Calls.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Dr. Radich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Paula Radich. I'm superintendent of the Newburgh Public Schools. Our district is located in the Chehalem Valley, 25 miles southwest of Portland. 5,068 students from the communities of Newburgh, Dundee, and parts of rural Hillsboro, Sherwood, and Wilsonville attend the Newburgh Public Schools. 4 years ago, I moved to Newburgh after serving 16 years as an administrator in a K-12 education system in the state of Washington. I'm a native Oregonian. I left Oregon in 1983 because as an educator, I believe that our core mission of teaching and learning was becoming increasingly compromised by the time devoted to budget reductions and funding dilemmas. I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bills 87, 88, and 89. If passed, these bills will continue the gradual erosion of the principles of equity and opportunity for every child in Oregon. While these bills create opportunities for children in some districts, they harm students in others. Our legislators must embrace the welfare of all of Oregon's school children. While the Newburgh Public Schools would potentially gain financially from the passage of these bills, the impact of carving out additional resources for high-growth districts from our already diminished state school fund is irresponsible. The Newburgh community is a study in contrast. We are an equity district. However, it is possible we might also qualify as a high-growth district, as defined in the bills presented today. We are a rural community with few major industries. Our district benefited directly from equity dollars in the 1990s. Equity funding and the state school fund formula infused needed resources into our classrooms. While Newburgh retains a small town feeling of livability, like its neighbors to the north, our community experienced significant growth during the past decade, a 30% increase in population in the last 7 years. By the year 2020, the population is projected to double to an estimated 40,000. Despite demographic changes, the principal industries in our county remain agriculture and forestry. We are designated a rural county. Our community has a vision for managed growth. Unlike some of our neighboring districts that have literally exploded in population, our community takes a conservative and measured approach to growth. We build the infrastructure and protect farmland. Under Senate Bill 89, districts that carefully manage their growth are penalized. Under Senate Bill 89, districts that lose enrollment are penalized. Under Senate Bill 89, districts that remain static in enrollment are penalized. In November of this school year, despite high unemployment and a faltering local economy, our community approved a construction bond for $46.3 million. Due to the lack of business and industry in our community, local homeowners will bear the brunt of the bond issue, paying an estimated $1.70 per $1,000 of assessed value in the first year of the bond. Communities in Hillsboro and Beaverton, however, can spread out construction costs among a larger base of citizens and businesses. The growth in these communities is supported by growth in business and industry. This is not the case in most rural districts. Many rural districts face an uncertain future of sending their children to school in aging and dilapidated buildings. The state of Oregon should establish a state school construction fund similar to that established in the state of Washington. Changing the state school funding formula now to offset construction costs in high-growth districts is not sound. The Washington state model is an equity-based model that permits rural districts with declining enrollment and low assessed value to access funds at a different rate than high-growth districts with high assessed value. In essence, the model is based upon equity and opportunity. Senate Bills 87 and 88 only serve the high-growth districts that already have high assessed value. Aren't children in our rural communities as deserving of decent school buildings as those in high-growth districts? And finally, their stewardship. Nearly 555,000 kindergarten through 12th grade students skate, cycle, walk, drive, and ride every day to Oregon's public schools. Who is responsible for all of Oregon's children? we are. While you represent your constituents in your home districts, you are charged with stewardship for the public school system in the state of Oregon. Senate Bills 87, 88, and 89 create inequities and change the focus in Oregon's priorities from equity to a heavy concentration on Metro. I ask the Metro districts to visit rural Willamina, Sheridan, Yamhill-Carlton, Amity, and the rural districts in eastern and southern Oregon represented by your constituents on this committee. You will see inequities. Those inequities will be exacerbated by the passage of any of the bills presented today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Inga.
I appreciate your comments, Socratic. You know, the Portland metro area already sends $400 million a year to other parts of the state. You're aware of that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And what's the right amount that should be sent out of the Portland metro area a year?
I don't have that calculation. However, I believe that solution is to look at the state as a whole and to take a... We're all in this together. The problem is, as we began to take apart the state school funding formula, we're going to continue to create inequities. We have to work together to solve the problem.
Do you have suggestions for the growth impact problems that you heard about earlier?
I could tell you that we're in the same situation that you are, certainly on a smaller level. We're going to be building another two elementary schools, a high school, another middle school in 20 years.
So what's your solution?
My solution is continue to work toward the establishment of a state school construction fund with some kind of a formula similar to what the state of Washington uses.
But where would that money come from?
The state would have to configure a rainy day fund for school construction, and I think the legislature is incumbent to take a look at that. That's a growing need in our state, but it's a long-term goal. It can't happen, and this is not going to solve it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I have to take exception to the kind of questioning I'm hearing. The export of tax dollars from Portland to the other areas of the state comes about primarily as a result of the devastation of the rural economies, and that was public policy driven. Nationalized issues like the Spotted Owl and the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and those kinds of things. And the burden of the cost for those things has been shifted to the rural communities. But nobody from the rural communities has come to Portland and said, well, how much clean water do you think we ought to send to Portland? Or how much clean air do you think you deserve? Or how many agricultural products do you think you should consume? Because we send those products to Portland to be exported worldwide. You benefit from that economically. How much recreation do we think is reasonable to provide for the people for Portland? How much wilderness do you think you really need? I mean, you know, this whole idea that Portland has somehow got more rights to a quality education than citizens in any community in the state of Oregon is really offensive. And the bills here are, in the climate that we're in, mean-spirited and selfish and divisive. And I appreciate the chairman's airing the bill so that people get a good look at how these concepts will explode cooperation in the state of Oregon. And I think that's the only benefit hearing these bills have. But let's at least not insult the people from rural communities that come to say that this will harm their communities and that that these formulas that we've arrived at may seem inequitable if your community happens to be blessed in this decade with high incomes. Well, let's remind folks that in previous decades it was agricultural communities or forest products communities that had that blessing. Let's not punish the communities that are already economically devastated, and particularly let's not insult the community members that come here to talk about equity when they do testify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chair, as long as we're having this discussion, I do not mean to insult you. Apologize if I did. I also don't think these were brought in a mean-spirited or selfish manner. These questions are complex. I wholeheartedly disagree with Senator Farrelly about much of his comments made about the cause of rural Oregon's economy, and I'm not going to have that debate right now. But I do think we need to look at solving the difficulties faced by all communities in our state, rural, urban, and suburban. And one of my questions is, what is your solution? And I appreciate your responses in that regard. And I would just ask Senator Ferrioli to help me explore the solutions to the problems facing my community. And, you know, I regret, Senator, that you weren't here for the testimony. A school board member came down from Beaverton Hillsborough to testify about the difficulties facing our communities. And I hope you will work with me in solving those problems rather than getting in an argument about why they exist.
Thank you. These are, as we all know, anytime you breach the topic of the school formula, I think you touch on sensitivities. I remember 2 years ago and some of the work that was done both in the House and the Senate. And so into that, Ms. Lynch, you could wade very...
I just get to leap right in, huh?
If you could wade very gently, and I think you have an interesting perspective coming from both a suburban area for many years and then also now to a different rural or somewhat rural community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peggy Lynch, and I do currently live in Corvallis. But having been a citizen of Beaverton Schools for 25 years, I wanted to bring that perspective, as well as the fact that living in Corvallis now, a district with declining enrollment and closing schools. And as a native Oregonian, I actually have relatives from John Day to Gold Beach. So I do know what's going on in our schools statewide. But I do fully understand the need for high-growth districts to have some relief for operating costs related to that growth. And that's one part of the issue, and that's why I am tentatively supporting Senate Bill 89, although I'm not sure that the factor of 0.5 is the correct formula. Districts are often required to purchase or lease portable classrooms, pay land use permit fees and inspections related to those classrooms, and deal with other costs which no other Oregon school districts have to do unless they build new schools and have to outfit them or they're growing. If district patrons vote to build more schools, there are costs no longer allowed to be bonded, and you heard that today, but which still exist in opening a new school. Therefore, some accommodation to address those special costs is appropriate. And I would hope that there would be further research done on what kind of impact it is and whether a 0.5 or a 0.25 or a 0.1, whatever the appropriate thing is reasonable. And it will hurt Corvallis schools if you do that. I know that. But I also think that we need to address the differing costs of differing school districts. A state capital cost fund for schools is also appropriate, and I certainly agree with my neighbor here on that, both for building new schools and for the high costs of remodeling or repairing existing schools. So long as it is new money, we can't afford yet another cost out of the current insufficient revenues for schools, and therefore I don't support Senate Bills 87 or 88. It is appropriate that citizens in local communities where high growth is occurring to be allowed the opportunity to levy systems development charges for schools to help offset the burden of property tax bonding on current residents. The amount of the SDCs and which communities might levy such should be left to local communities and their elected officials, but the opportunity should be a part of state law. And I want to make another comment. Beaverton Schools, last I checked, had McKay School, which was built in 1925. So even though you have brand new schools, you also have the challenge of remodeling and assuring that current schools exist. Lastly, none of the above addresses the most critical issue facing Oregon public schools all over the state. We need a stable and adequate source of funding for K-12 schools. And as the Senate Revenue Committee, I am hopeful you will be a leader in that regard. I believe that about 85% of Oregon school children attend our public schools. As my husband and I both know, our public school system is the first step in any personal economic development plan. Our public schools still provide the great equalizer for all our children. Any bill you consider related to K-12 schools needs to be considered in the context of solving the greater problem. We need more money for our K-12 schools. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Bradish. Let's go. Ozzy Rose, Lori Wimmer Whalen, David Williams, and Rob, do you want to, Wagner? There you are. My eyes are bad. You want to come up and wait on deck?
Four people, three seats.
We don't have other shots if you want. I assume we'll have other shots if you don't want
to. Oh, I'm interested to hear. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Farrelly.
I'd rather not hear anybody refer to shots fired in this committee.
Yeah, it's true. Especially on this issue of all issues. Ozzy.
I'm sorry. I have a limited vocabulary.
Me too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and all of you out there know who I am and what I do. You also know that I've been in the equity battle rather knee-deep for a long time. The superintendents have a group of 40 superintendents who make our decision on these kinds of issues. They are meeting on February 25th. We met the 31st of January, and I outlined all the issues that looked like they were coming up. They're back talking to their constituents, their fellow superintendents, and they're in here all day on the 25th and supposed to give me my marching orders. Having said that, on these particular issues, we opposed them last time, as you know, and primarily because the issue was using operational money, shifting it into capital when we're very, very short of operational money, and Peggy just made that point. And we'll have these discussions, I'm sure. But I would like to, one, hopefully diffuse the issues about who spends money where. I think that the press did us a significant disservice in pumping up the $400 million argument. That happens. That's a fact. There's nothing you can do about that. We're a state of Oregon and all our wealth. And so I've done a little work on why we are where we are. And we have to talk about here's where we are, here are the facts. Now, what are we going to do? One of the facts, that this was presented to you in this committee earlier, and this year income tax by county. They showed, your staff showed you in 1990 and the year 2000, the average income tax. And this illustrates our problem. In 1990, the average income tax per person by county, the lowest was in Wheeler County, was $857. And the highest was Washington, at $1,870, about $1,000 different. But the average of that time was $1,400. So Wheeler, the residents of Wheeler were averaging about 61% of the average of the state, and in Washington County was 128% of the average. Roll forward 10 years, and the average now is 2416. Wheeler's still the lowest county in earnings, and there's probably fewer people there, by the way. And they're at 1348, or 55% of the average. While Washington County is $4,100 per person or per taxpayer, and they're at 170%. So the gap is wider. The wealth is moving, and Multnomah County is second, et cetera. So, and you go to population shifts. I have here from 1920 to 2020 by county our population shifts. Mm-hmm. And this is the year 1920. Purple counties are, by definition, federal government called vacant counties. And you may not have known that. We have vacant counties, we have frontier counties, and I'm sorry, I don't know the names of the other two.
The representation reflects that.
it's my understanding it came from the Homestead Act, and vacant counties where they wanted people to go. Anyway, that's what our state looked like in 1920. Here's what it looks like in 2020. And I've got all the 10 years in between if it interests you. And the issue isn't there are fewer vacant counties. The issue is look at the difference in the metro area and the valley. You already know this, but I'm trying to put it in perspective. The wealth, whether it's income, property, or consumption, the wealth is in the corridor and primarily in the three counties. But the state is this big. Anecdotal. I'm from Eastern Washington, and some of you know that. And the only thing I've done besides schoolwork and what I do now, if you call that schoolwork, at School Connect at least, is work on a dryland wheat farm. And I started that in the late 50s. I worked for the same farmer from 1959 to 1974 when I took the COSA job. I worked every single school break, spring, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and summer, on the farm. And when I went to work there, the farmer had a elementary age son and a one-year-old son. And I don't know if you know about dryland wheat farming, but you don't have enough water to farm all your ground every year, so you leave half of it fallow, collect water, so you only grow a crop every other year. That's for you city guys. And so you talk about how much you farm. Well, we farm 900 acres 1 year and 1,200 the next. That farm now is run by the two sons, and they farm 3,500 acres 1 year and over 5,000 the next. Eight local farms have shut down, and they've taken over the ground. So there's two families now farming that 8,500 acres. That 8,500 acres is still sending the same amount of product, and actually more because of fertilizer and so forth, to the food chain or to the economy or whatever, but only two families are doing it. Those two families don't have as many kids as the 10 did, but those kids that are there deserve services. They need the same roads and same bridges. The farmland's all in the same places. We need the same infrastructure to move the crop to the city. And so to get in a discussion about and argue about that we're sending the money out, it's a state issue. And I would like us to focus on that. The other issue is that we've argued in all the discussions about the fund, we need a building support fund. There is no equity in how we take care of our buildings. And we've said that since we started this mess. Now, we got into this equity argument because the metro counties voted for Measure 5. They wanted this. And we have but that's a fact, and we have to deal with it. We've never had any kind of equity in how do you deal with buildings, whether it's repair old ones, put in a boiler, or whether it's build new ones. And we get to looking at different size schools. Well, that school district's got this huge percentage-wise reserve. And we don't have a reserve, very big one. Well, that little tiny school district, that reserve may or may not pay for the boiler if it goes out in their own building. So that you got to pay attention to all that stuff. And I have an answer, Senator, for the building fund, and we've argued on that. Let's levy $1 or $2 statewide and put it in a matching fund for buildings. And I'm going to build a building in Beaverton, I'm going to repair one in John Day or whatever. The locals are going to pay 60% of it, the matching fund. I mean, that's ballpark how Washington's worked. But we've been so focused on our tax problems in Oregon to try to keep the operations going, we've never addressed that seriously.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me.
Senator Corcoran.
So, Ozzy, what, just ballpark, since that's one of our favorite terms in this, what is the estimate of how much money that pot would have to start out with?
I don't know how much it'd start out with. I know we raise a dollar. We raise about $500 million, I think, per year on a dollar statewide tax. Isn't that about bought for it?
I'd have to look at it.
You'd have to get it. I don't think you can all of a sudden have enough and wait until it grows in endowment and just use the interest. You'd have to have a steady stream like a statewide tax, or else you'd never get enough to really do it. So I think you'd have to do something like I just suggested to get annual revenue into that pot in order to make it worthwhile for the people building it.
So this notion, Mr. Chair, for instance, of doing a statewide 1% property tax for something like that would be a consideration?
Well, from my perspective, is yeah. I don't know if it is anybody else's. There's got to be a revenue stream to put in. I understand that.
The point I'm trying to make is I'm reinforcing your argument that you can't argue about money pouring in from, it's the dependency on the income tax that's causing that problem. And just, a property tax, at least on the commercial and business property that got the breaks of Measure 5, would make them pay a more equitable part of the school bill.
And all of us have different view of what's more equitable, as you know. But the only point I want to make out of this is that you got these three bills, and you're going to get one on
mining
enrollment. I'm going to get one on forest fees. That we already know that we're going to get a formula bill related to special education and the small schools, because you asked for a study at the last session. We said, let's put this off. We have good data. You got some decent data that you're going to have to look at that has some ideas in it. So you've got all of these, and the constraints you're under is that we don't have, I suspect that what you heard the last couple hours wasn't very good information. And if we, by the way, one of, now shut up. If we had had over the last 12 years increase in school funding that kept up with inflation, we wouldn't be here fussing about much about the formula.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would be relatively happy with the formula. And unfortunately, on a per-student distribution aimed at equity, and it reminds you of this, I've told you before, we're the only state that tried to create equity in school funding without putting a significant amount of money into the pot to grow the people up from the bottom. We decided to create equity in a time when we didn't add it when we had it in the good times, and we created equity by rearranging the money that was there, by and large. And so,
Ozzie, the concern on that is, I mean, and that's what I've heard, is the three solutions put forward, and I think the first panel in some ways echoed this, the three solutions, whether it's SDCs or that, which is in a declining dollar environment, we chose equity. And then the third, the school capitalization fund, those are all three that if you look back over the 12 years, last 12 years, and certainly the part that I spent here, those are ideas that really, I can't think of any of them, that really took root in this building. And then you reverse that and you look at the changes that were made, even the changes last session that were made, and we have tweaked the formula. We've
right.
gone into
yep.
it. And if you looked at the nature of those, there does seem to be, a pattern does emerge in terms of concerns over here, unaddressed, and that could be policy, politics, the whole nine yards, but you see changes over here that negatively, and you see, well, here are the some of the fixes, and those haven't gained much ground around here. And I don't know, COSA's taken a position. I know last session COSA did take a position on the small school correction.
Right. And we'd have done some good stuff on SDCs if we didn't have John Chandler around here.
He's up next. He's up next. Although we're almost out of time. So, but Ozzie, I mean, that is a very, I think, a legitimate concern that you just look at the balance sheet and the changes that actually got signed into law and the ones that were kind of offered up, there is an imbalance I would offer up.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senoriga.
And I have to go, but I would just also offer that there really does need to be consideration the extent that high-growth areas generate wealth for the entire state. You know, and with respect to my colleagues from rural Oregon whose schools, I do agree they're in our state, and we need to make sure everybody in the state has a good education. One of the ways to do that is to make sure that businesses locate in Washington County. And if the school crowding pushes them over to Vancouver, that's going to be less money available to help rural schools. And I would welcome your assistance in solving this problem and not just continuing an argument. So, thank you.
I don't know if those aren't supposed to comment on.
we're running very short. Do you want to, Ozzie, do you want to comment? Or?
No, I'll be quiet.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Miss Wimmer Whalen's lost her voice, so she's not going to be a problem. And David's really shy.
Unfortunately, due to our late start, we really are running. We're losing our members.
I've given you my written testimony, then you can just read that.
Did you have key points? Or?
Well, okay. Mr. Chair and committee member, for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with OEA. As I said, I have submitted my written testimony. I echo everything Ozzie just said. We believe that the problem that was identified is without doubt a very important problem and needs remedy. We just disagree that these bills represent that remedy. We, too, believe that SDCs would be one way. Perhaps this other idea of Ozzie's would be another, although, you know, there are some other conversations about how best to spend money that you might go back out to the ballot to get the citizens to support. But we just can't support raiding the pot from other schools, whether a child comes from Eagle Point or Condon or you know, any of the other smaller districts. They didn't create this mess, and they shouldn't pay for the problem. And
Lori,
so,
how do you – I mean, I guess my question still kind of lingers out there. How do you respond to the changes that we've made over the last 12 years? I mean, if you just look at – the balance sheet, we have made changes. We have had these conversations. They're difficult conversations.
Mr. Chair, I agree that that's been the case. But if you look at the playing field, when there were 17 or 18 different formula tweaks proposed last session, some of them fairly drastic, and one modest one got through. Most of the rest of them we opposed, and my colleagues all did as well. And I think if you look at the total number of dollars, that we were money ahead for having done that. This one is a significant bite, and dollar for dollar, it doesn't compare. I think in the end, the solution is not how you slice the pie, but how big the pie is that you bake to begin with. And I think that if we all really care about a solution, this Revenue Committee and the House Revenue Committee ought to be taking up tax reform now in this legislative session, and we ought to make sure that we can float all boats. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
I have one question. So is OEA involved in any kind of organization that's helping look at the replacement revenue question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, yes, we are.
And would that be the Coalition for Oregon's Future?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Citizens for Oregon's Future.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
So we are out there hoping to raise the literacy level of the average Oregonian with respect to this so we can deliver a positive public next time something comes to the ballot.
Yeah, which you're right. That's where the battle is. I agree.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, David Williams, Oregon School Employees Association, ditto. We need more money for schools, and that would go a long way to solving the problem. SDCs are a great idea. And I believe the correction last session, we opposed it because it was originally our school bus bill. So we wanted that one. But you have my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rob, do you want to?
Yeah, the large thump you heard was John Chandler falling off his chair.
Anyone else want to bless SDCs while we're... Randy, is he still here? Randy Tucker?
Mr. Chair.
He's gone.
I do want to make one comment about the tweak that we did do last time was a classic compromise because it took a $27 million pot of money that came in. It spread 9 to the rural schools and the rest went in the general pot. So it benefited everybody.
well, we're out of time. So thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And with that, we will close the public hearings on Senate Bill 87, 88, and 89, and adjourn the Senate revenue.